Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News, brought to you by volunteers at Canada's community radio stations. This week, Groundwire is produced at CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. I'm your host this week, Erin Hudson. But first, here are the headlines. Last week, Tim Hortons announced a new policy regarding its pork supply change. In 10 years, Tim's promises to have transitioned from buying pork from animals kept in gestation crates to open housing crates. Gestation crates confine pigs for their entire lives within small enclosed crates, too small for them to turn around. The crate system is criticized by veterinarians, farmers, animal welfare advocates, and animal scientists. 9 American states and the European Union have banned them as well. The use of gestation crates is a 30-year-old trend that may now be coming to a gradual end. Other major food companies have recently made similar announcements, including Oscar Mayer, McDonald's, Burger King, Wendy's, Costco, Safeway, and Kroger. Other pork producers include Maple Leaf Foods, Smithfield, Hormel, and Amal. They've all announced their intention to stop using gestation crates within their own facilities. The Portland-Montreal Pipeline Corporation has stated it has no plans to reverse the flow of its Line 9 pipeline, which would carry Canadian tar sands oil into Maine for export. However, residents remain wary. Enbridge, the company that owns the pipeline, has already applied to the National Energy Board for the reversal of Line 9 to transport heavy crude oil. Many people in opposition to the pipeline in Maine see this as an opening that will eventually permit Enbridge to begin transporting tar sands oil. Between the lines, Melinda Tuhus reports from an anti-Line 9 rally held in January in Portland, Maine.
Dylan Voorhees works with the Natural Resources Council of Maine.
Right now, it carries regular crude oil north and west, but Alberta is sitting on a mountain of tar sands buried under the forests and the soils, and they're digging it out. And they're putting it in dump trucks the size of your house. The big oil companies want to get that tar sands out of Alberta to global energy markets, and that means getting it onto tankers. And the only thing standing in their way is us. A lot of states, a lot of provinces, they're trying to get it down Keystone to the Gulf. They're trying to get it across British Columbia to the Pacific. And they want to try and send it through this pipeline and reverse the flow down to Portland. The pipeline company is still saying they don't have an active plan to send tar sands through Maine. Just like I don't have an active plan for dinner yet tonight.
Emily Figdor is Executive Director of Environment Maine.
The presidential permit allows them to transport oil across the international border. But it says nothing, nothing about tar sands oil. And that gives President Obama and his State Department, which is soon to be run by Senator John Kerry.
Yeah, Kerry! Our pal!
It gives the president and John Kerry the chance to require a new permit and a new environmental review. We all heard President Obama talk about climate change in his inaugural address. He spent more time on it than any other issue. He declared that a failure to act would betray our children and future generations. This pipeline project, the tar sands fight, more broadly, keeping tar sands in the ground, that's at the core of the climate fight. But the only way that President Obama can stick his neck out on this issue and require a new permit and a new process is if we all give him reason to do so, that we speak out so loudly that he responds.
On Friday, April 5th, 279 people were arrested in violation of a Montreal bylaw against public protests. We go to a headline by Aaron Lakoff from Free Speech Radio News for more.
During the month of March, police made more than 400 arrests during several demonstrations under a bylaw known as P6. Montreal City Council enacted P6 last year during the height of the massive historic student strike in Quebec to help police break up political demonstrations. Under the bylaw, any protest march which does not give its route to the police in advance is illegal. In the last month, Montreal police have broken up several protests before they began, using a controversial kettling tactic to surround the crowd and often arresting hundreds at a time. While those arrested under P6 are not criminally charged, they are issued fines of more than $600, which protesters claim are excessive. Several groups made an appeal to the provincial government to overturn the bylaw, but the Quebec Premier Pauline Marois supports the measure. However, in September, Marois repealed Bill 12, a provincial piece of legislation with similar anti-protest measures. Cybèle Ataoul, a lawyer with the Association of Progressive Jurists, says the P6 bylaw violates the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, which is part of the Canadian Constitution.
The freedom of expression and the freedom of peaceful assembly are provided for in the Canadian and Quebec charters. And this law basically means that if, you know, you can't have, even if your protest is peaceful, it can be deemed illegal if you didn't provide the route and the route didn't get approved by the police. Therefore, it can have an effect of stifling a peaceful protest, and it makes it virtually impossible to have spontaneous protest.
Friday night, several hundred protesters are expected to gather in downtown Montreal in a mass civil disobedience against the bylaw. Provisions of the P6 law are currently being challenged at the Superior Court of Quebec, which is expected to make a judgment on the case this fall. The Association of Progressive Jurists is asking the court to repeal the entire bylaw.
Our final headline comes from a story covered by the Halifax Media Co-op's Moira Peters. In a historical ruling by the Supreme Court, the Pictou Landing Band Council will be reimbursed for all costs associated with the caring for Jeremy while he lives with his mother, who 3 years ago had a double stroke that left her unable to continue caring for her son as she had been doing for his whole life. Jeremy is a 17-year-old from Pictou Landing First Nation who was born with a complex array of disabilities and medical conditions. His mother, Maureena Beadle, has been providing all his care without government assistance until a double stroke in May 2010 left her physically unable to meet his needs at home. When, with Pictou's help, she applied for funding for home care health services, she found that her family's Aboriginal status caught her son in a jurisdictional red tape that prevented him from receiving the same care on reserve that he would have been provided by the province of Nova Scotia had he lived off reserve. Jeremy's case was heard in Nova Scotia in June 2012. It was the first time that Jordan's principle, a child-first policy designed to ensure that First Nations children receive the same health care that non-Native kids do, was invoked. The principle was passed unanimously in the House of Commons in 2007 after Jordan River Anderson, a Cree child in Manitoba, died in hospital while waiting for the provincial and federal governments to duke it out over which level of government was responsible for paying for his home care. In spite of broad support, Jordan's principle has never been implemented in Canada until now. The court victory has widespread implications for cases similar to Jeremy's across Canada. The ruling sets a precedent which has the potential to open up cases in other social services where First Nations people fall through jurisdictional cracks because of their Aboriginal status. That's it for the headlines. We'll be right back after this. That was Shallow Waters by Takea Blaney and Eileen De La Cruz. Takea is a 10-year-old Silamon, First Nation from BC, Canada. The song reflects her attention to environmental concerns, especially the preservation of marine and coastal wildlife. She sang the song outside an Enbridge office after she was not permitted inside to deliver a letter she'd written to the major oil company's officials opposing the Northern Gateway pipeline. Now it's time for our feature stories. Our first feature comes out of Denzin Bay, otherwise known as the Northwest Territories. CKLB Radio is a station that is part of the Native Communications Program and broadcast to Denzin Bay in six languages. We hear from the radio director, Denise Nakeko, how and why CKLB took part in I Don't Know More in their own way this winter.
The Native Communications Society is a nonprofit organization. So a big chunk of our operating budget actually comes from Canadian Heritage. They have the Northern Aboriginal Broadcasting Aboriginal Peoples Program. So we've been getting our core budget from Canadian Heritage for the whole life of our organization. It's probably around 30 years. Funding hasn't changed. We've been getting the same amount of funding. Every year we ask for a little bit more because of change in broadcasting, new equipment. We have to be competitive with our salaries for our staff. But over the last couple of years, it's been very, I'm just trying to find the best way to put it. It's been very difficult in order to actually receive our funding, applying for our funding. We get it every year from Canadian Heritage, but it takes a lot longer. They want more information, and it eats up a lot of the time, administrative time. And a lot of that time we can be spent in actually programming and doing the job that we want to do. But we find a lot of our time is to filling out our applications for contribution agreements with the federal government, especially Canadian Heritage. We also bring in revenue through advertising, but not a lot. So we rely a lot on our core funding from Canadian Heritage. The thing is that it takes a long time for them to actually pay us our contribution agreements. We get four payments throughout the year, and then we were still waiting for payment from 2011. In December 2012, we still hadn't received our last payment for 2011. We didn't even get our first or second payment for 2012. We've been trying to call Canadian Heritage. We've been trying to talk to them. But it's been pretty difficult for us. So as a measure, we went off the radio for just over a week during the Christmas holidays, between December 25th and January 1st. And it was kind of like a protest a little bit to our relationship with Canadian Heritage. It seems to have worked out. Canadian Heritage actually sent some representatives to come check out our operation, which is the first time that's ever happened with us. In January 2013, we have been in contact with them, and we actually got payment for 2011 in January 2013. We got our last payment for 2011, then we got our first payment for 2012. So even though the payment was late, there was some movement. And we were able to continue broadcasting as usual. And when we shut down, through our website, we asked our listeners to contact Canadian Heritage to convey to them how important we are to the people of the communities. I think the similarities with Idle No More is that we just don't want to be sitting around and waiting for stuff to happen. We actually want to take action and come up with a mutually beneficial working relationship with the Canadian government. It shouldn't be like this, and we shouldn't have to do the things that we do in order to remain viable. We're another perspective of news and information aside from mainstream media or other media organizations here in the North. And that perspective that we provide is from the perspective of the people in the communities. They appreciate it, and it's our mandate in order for us to do that. And the perspective is unique to this part of the world, and unique to the needs of the people up here. And we try to adhere to that. But I think with Idle No More, it was just like there's a general feeling across Canada with First Nations people and their relationship with this country that we call Canada. A lot of people are fed up about a lot of different things. And I would say that our relationship was just an example of that.
Remember the salty ocean breeze, used to build castles on the beach, splashing around in the summer heat. There was just oil up to our knees. Bring back the days we used to care, when all of these troubles were not there.
Now it's time for our community radio report. This report comes from Carly Green at CKUT, Montreal.
Community radio stations are mandated to represent the communities that they're a part of. And so obviously, there's no one definition of what they look like. They vary as a function of the communities they serve. But how flexible that definition is sometimes comes into question, as it did this year with Seaside FM's agreement with the Canadian Armed Forces. Seaside FM is a community radio station based in Halifax, Nova Scotia, and is self-described easy listening. Okay, would you mind saying something for me, anything?
It's really a cold day in Halifax today.
Is Wayne Harrett, Seaside FM's program director.
Seaside FM is a not-for-profit community radio station that offers community programming for the mature adults throughout the HRM. And mature adults, we mean the baby boomers and the senior citizens of this area. We offer a wide range of programming, from easy listening to big band music, jazz music, barbershop music, and spoken word program that is geared towards the baby boomers.
The controversy at Seaside is over its Memorandum of Understanding with the Canadian Armed Forces, signed last September, which agrees to having several active reserve soldiers work as volunteers for the station while on pay from the Canadian military.
G9 Lieutenant Colonel King speaking.
Hi. Lieutenant Colonel Sanchez King was largely responsible for coordinating the Memorandum of Understanding, and he explained that it was created as a means to train soldiers on radio skills so they could set up radio stations in other countries if necessary. He told me about one such station, Radio Rena.
So this is a radio that broadcasts to the civilian population in Kandahar province. So when we stopped running that radio station because the Canadian Army had moved away from combat operations and moved up to the training in Kabul. Really, the concern that I had was that we were no longer maintaining the skills required to run radio stations, radio broadcasts, and that other members of the organization weren't getting those skills.
And so rather than pay for the reserve soldiers to attend school, it occurred to Lieutenant King that they could work alongside volunteers at Seaside in order to practice the skills required to make radio.
Community radio can offer that services that the mainstream radio cannot.
Again, Wayne Harrett, Seaside's program director.
They are basically here learning how to do radio, and like the regular general public can do too. The door is open to anybody to come in and learn radio.
Peter Piper picked a peck of pickle peppers.
This is Major Mark Guff, the Army's public affairs officer in the Atlantic area. While at Seaside FM, the soldiers worked on a couple of radio pieces directly pertaining to the military. He had the idea for one of the special pieces that the reserve soldiers at Seaside produced on Reserve Soldiers Day. He explained how the project came about.
Our Army Reserve Recognition Day was set aside as a way to formally recognize the contribution that these folks make to the Army and the Canadian Forces in general. Colonel King and his crew were already working towards the Memorandum of Understanding with Seaside FM, and we saw that as an opportunity, as another piece of our communications effort to talk to folks and to communicate to people what Army Reserve Recognition Day and the important contribution that our reservists are making. So we sat down with them and we came up with a plan. My office would draft some messages that could be recorded by some of our key leaders.
So the soldiers went and recorded messages from military officials living and working in the Halifax area.
And then so Lieutenant Colonel King and his guys, they cleaned up the messages, and you know, they added a little bit of something something. And one of the messages had the sound of soldiers marching just before the voice of one of the key leaders spoke. And then they worked with the radio station. The radio station helped them perfect the sound bite and the message and the levels and all the technical gear that goes along with that, but the radio station worked with them on that. And then during Army Reserve Recognition Day, they played these messages at different intervals throughout the day. I think they were broadcast 8 times.
One major objection that some in the community radio, community, have raised with CSAT FM soldier volunteers is that soldiers don't have complete freedom of expression in regards to the military while they're on active duty, as the soldiers at Seaside are. According to the National Defense Act, active soldiers are prohibited from criticizing the Department of National Defense or the Canadian government, with penalties that can be as serious as prison. Here's Lieutenant Colonel Sanchez King.
We endeavor to, and within the memorandum of understanding, we endeavor to make sure that the radio station, in terms of the content and the editorial aspects, that it continues to meet its mandate and it is unaffected by its relationship with the Canadian forces.
I think it's a safe assumption.
Again, Mark Goff.
They're not going to say anything that that's disparaging towards the Army, because they're looking at this as an opportunity for themselves. If someone has an opinion about the Army, they don't like something about the Army, they can always leave. The Canada doesn't have a conscripted military. This is an entirely voluntary force. If the military is going in a direction that you don't agree with, or there's policies that you don't agree with, you can always leave.
But some people have nonetheless argued that if the soldiers are going to be producing radio about the military, then there should be some kind of a disclaimer warning the audience that there might be a conflict of interest.
I'm not aware of any of the requirement or request to put some sort of disclaimer on there, and I'm not sure exactly how I'd have to ask around to see how we would do that, or if we would really want or see the need to do that. And I think that's more of an issue for Seaside FM to address. If they don't feel comfortable with the arrangement that we have and what the soldiers are actually reporting on or talking about on the radio.
According to Wayne Harrett, there is a disclaimer of sorts.
We have not put a disclaimer on, but if we have to, we would. But we have made it clear to our listening audience by saying this program is being produced in partnership with the members of the military and also and the station Seaside FM.
Oh, so you do have a kind of disclaimer, I guess.
A disclaimer, yeah.
It's unclear if this kind of announcement is effective in alerting the station's audience to a potential conflict of interest. But Harrit didn't seem too worried about it. If anything, he's grateful for the changes that the military has brought to the station.
Normally, here at Seaside, we have every November 11th, we put together our own very own Remembrance Day broadcast, which was well received. But this year, we decided, since we had the members of the forces here, that they could produce their very own two-hour special, where they have the connections that we don't have, can't get to, and they had the interviews of the older vets and the younger vets, and with our input on, let's say, the music that was included in the program, it was very well received by our listening audience.
For Seaside, with a much older demographic.
Arby Frew is the music director at CHLY, a campus community radio station in BC.
That's not likely to be as anti-military as our station is. That would, it might be okay for them. As long as it's, not a problem for other announcers to feel like they can't criticize the military, or for listeners who, as far as the listeners are concerned, is a problem more of perception than, it sounds like, than actual, like if they think the radio station is pro-military as opposed to it actually being pro-military. It's still, if the listeners or the announcers don't feel that it's a problem, and they can turn it off if they don't like it, then I don't suppose it's a problem for them.
What it really seems to come down to is a fundamental disagreement over the mandate of community radio stations and what counts as the radio station's community. And in Halifax and at Seaside FM, says Lieutenant King, people count the military as part of the community.
But certainly in the case of Seaside FM, and I suspect others across the country, having a connection with a community also involves members of the Canadian Reserve Force and the Canadian Regular Force, who are parts of that population.
But for Gretchen King, including the military in the community of community radio falls far outside its mandate. She's a member of the National Campus Community Radio Association and sits on the board of directors at CKUT, a campus community radio station in Montreal.
From my experience within the National Campus Community Radio Association and also my understanding of what broadcasting means in regulation, campus community radio is mandated to serve those who are marginalized by the mainstream media. So for me, to consider the military marginalized or misrepresented or underrepresented in the other media, i.e. not community radio, is hard to understand, because every time I turn on CBC, I often see a story about military families or soldiers returning or soldiers at war, whether they are in Afghanistan or they're working in Haiti. I basically see very very easy access and a lot of information about not only the military itself, but about its members and about its families. So I don't think that this addresses a gap that exists. I know that people reacted expressing concern that these are members of the community, and a community radio station is inclusive of everybody. And while it's true that there's no norm for who a community radio station represents, and there's a lot of hybridity within our sector, basically community radio stations are meant to reflect the communities that are around them. But even in that understanding, we have to look at what is available in the mediascape in that community. You know, Nova Scotia and Seaside FM are not separate from the Canadian media landscape. And so when we see a presence of the military in our media already, in the mainstream media landscape, we really have to question this kind of arrangement, whether it's addressing a gap or it's an extension of the power that the military already has in the media into the campus community radio sector. And so that's why I have a lot of concerns.
For now, Seaside's memorandum of understanding with the Canadian Armed Forces stands, and the soldiers will continue volunteering and training there. But Gretchen King said she hoped the episode would provoke a more in-depth discussion on the mandate of community radio at the next NCRA meeting, which will take place later this year. For Groundwire, I'm Carla Green.
That's it for this edition of Groundwire from CKUT in Montreal. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Erin Hudson. Music this week was by Takaya Blaney and Eileen De La Cruz. Headlines this week were written by Erin Hudson and Moira Peters. We also thank Frida Warren, Carla Green, and the Media Co-op. Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station or download at groundwire.ncra.ca. Groundwire is a project of the National Campus and Community Radio Association.
I can't see your clear waves slapping at my feet.